VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant and Anna Mateo. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
A continuing lack of rain in parts of Brazil has officials and experts concerned that forest fires will again be a problem this year. In Brazil, forest fire season is coming. The government space agency uses satellites to observe fires. It reported recently that more areas burned in July of this year than in any July since 2016. Most Brazilian fires are caused by humans. They are often started by companies or people claiming land as their own. They burn down and clear trees to raise cattle or grow crops. Historical records show that fires usually start increasing in June and reach their highest numbers in September. Fires can easily get out of control during the dry season, burning large areas of forest. Brazil is home to the Amazon, the world's largest rainforest. It also is home to wetlands known as the Pantanal, also the world's largest wetlands. Both had many fires in 2019 and 2020 that caused the most forest loss in years. That led to criticism of the administration of President Jair Bolsonaro. He has repeatedly called for development in the Amazon. This year, the Cerrado Savannah is having more fires than usual. The grassland stretches across the central and western part of Brazil. A large area is said to have burned there in the first 7 months of the year. Anny Alencar is science director at the Amazon Environmental Research Institute. During an online meeting on July 27th, she said there have been fewer Amazon fires this year because of cool weather. But she is afraid of what will happen when the weather changes. "I'm not sure that the people who cut down the forest will not light it," she said. Brazil is also experiencing its most severe drought in 90 years. Officials announced on July 22nd that a large group of experts will study fires in the Amazon, Pantanal, and Cerrado and how to prevent them. The group includes about 6,000 federal and state police, firefighters, state public security, and environmental officials. On June 29th, Bolsonaro ordered redeployment of soldiers to the Amazon to combat fires and deforestation. He also issued a 120-day ban on unauthorized outdoor fires. Similar measures in earlier years did not prevent illegal fires. More than 90% of the Pantanal hotspots found in 2020 came after a similar presidential ban. That information comes from Vinicius Silgueiro, an expert at the Center of Life Institute in Mato Grosso State. The sense of impunity is very high. Enforcement is well below what is necessary, Silgueiro said. Plant life in the Amazon rainforest takes about 2 billion tons of carbon dioxide out of the Earth's atmosphere each year. Human activity around the world is estimated to produce 40 billion tons yearly. That makes the Amazon an important part of the world's effort to fight climate change. But a study led by a Brazilian ministry and published in July discovered something else. It found that the southeastern Amazon rainforest, heavily affected by logging, has been releasing more carbon than it stored. Paulo Artachu is professor of environmental physics at the University of São Paulo in Brazil. He is also a member of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Artachu said, other recent studies have shown that areas in the western Amazon are now carbon neutral. A few years ago, scientists said it was a place that stored carbon. Carlos Nobre is a climate scientist. He said Brazil's thick forest will stop being wet enough to remain in its current form. It will begin to become grassland. Nobre said Bolsonaro's administration still has not done enough to save the rainforest. He said the federal government continues to do nothing about illegal logging, deforestation, and fires in the Amazon. I'm Alice Bryant.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. More than half of the cosmetics sold in the United States and Canada have dangerous chemicals connected with serious health conditions. A new study claims that those conditions include cancer and reduced birth weight in newborn babies. Cosmetics are substances that you put on your face or body to improve appearance. Another name for cosmetics is makeup. Researchers at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana tested more than 230 commonly used cosmetics. They found that 56% of foundations and eye products, 48% of lip products, and 47% of mascaras contain fluorine. The Associated Press recently reported on the story and explained fluorine this way. Fluorine is an irritating gaseous chemical element. Fluorine is also an indicator of the so-called forever chemicals called PFAS, spelled P-F-A-S. The man-made PFAS molecules contain fluorine and are used in some cooking containers, floor coverings, and many other products. Some of the highest PFAS levels were found in waterproof mascara and long-lasting lipstick. This is just one of the findings of the study published recently in the journal Environmental Science and Technology Letters. Researchers did additional testing on 29 products found to have higher fluorine amounts. The researchers found they contain between 4 and 13 specific PFAS chemicals. However, only one of those tested products listed PFAS as an ingredient on its container. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration oversees cosmetics in the country. A spokesperson for the agency said, "The FDA does not comment on specific studies." The FDA said on its website that there have been few studies on the amount of the chemicals in cosmetics. And the published studies usually found very low levels of the chemicals. The FDA website also notes that such low levels are not likely to cause harm. A fact sheet published on the agency's website says, "As the science on PFAS in cosmetics continues to advance, the FDA will continue to analyze data from the cosmetics industry as well as published research." The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is also collecting industry data on the use of PFAS chemicals and connected health risks. It is considering regulations to reduce possible risks caused by the chemicals. On its website, the EPA states that PFAS chemicals stay in the environment and in the human body for a very long time. They do not break down and can build up over time. The site adds that there is evidence that exposure to PFAS can lead to several health problems. PFAS chemicals are an issue of increasing concern for lawmakers who are working to control their use in consumer products. The study results were announced as a group of U.S. senators introduced a bill to ban the use of PFAS in cosmetics and other beauty products. The move to ban PFAS comes as Congress considers legislation. The legislation aims to set a national drinking water standard for some PFAS chemicals. It also includes cleaning up polluted areas across the United States. Widespread testing in recent years has found high levels of PFAS in many public water systems and military bases. "There is nothing safe and nothing good about PFAS," said Senator Richard Blumenthal, a Democrat from the state of Connecticut. He introduced the cosmetics bill with Senator Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine. Representative Debbie Dingell, a Democrat from Michigan, has supported several PFAS-related bills in the House of Representatives. She has looked for PFAS in her own beauty products. However, she could not see if they were present because the products were not correctly marked. Blumenthal calls himself a fighter for the consumer. Companies that want to avoid possible government regulation should voluntarily go PFAS-free, Blumenthal added. He said that while he does not wear makeup products, he and his supporters have a message for the cosmetics industry. "We've trusted you, and you betrayed us." And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report I'm Ana Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They planned to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, the leaders wrote a completely new constitution. It created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. Last week, we told how the group reached agreement on the position and powers of a national executive. They decided the executive could veto laws, and they decided the person could be removed from office if found guilty of serious crimes. We also told about the debate on a national judiciary. The delegates approved a federal system of courts and judges. These courts would hear cases involving national laws, the rights of American citizens, and wrongdoing by foreign citizens in the country. State courts would continue to hear cases involving state laws. Next, the delegates began to discuss competing proposals for a national legislature. This would be the most hotly debated issue of the convention. It forced the question of equal representation. Would small states and large states have an equal voice in the central government? The convention had already agreed that the national legislature would have two houses. It had not agreed, however, on the number of representatives each state would have in each house. The large states wanted representation based on population, but the small states believed they would lose power to the large states. They wanted representation to be the same for all states, no matter what the size. One day, Gunning Bedford of Delaware, one of the smallest states, looked straight at the delegates from the largest states. "Gentlemen," he shouted, "I do not trust you. If you try to crush the small states, you will destroy the Confederation. And if you do, the small states will find some foreign ally of more honor and good faith who will take them by the hand and give them justice." The debate on legislative representation, big states against small states, lasted for weeks that summer in Philadelphia. The delegates could not agree, so they debated other parts of the proposal. One involved the names of the two houses of the legislature. Most spoke of them simply as the first branch and the second branch. We will speak of them by the names used today, the House of Representatives and the Senate. Next came the question, who could be elected to the House and Senate? Delegates did not take long to decide. Members of the House, they agreed, must be at least 25 years old. They must have been citizens of the United States for 7 years. And at the time of election, they must live in the state in which they are chosen. The delegates agreed that members of the Senate must be at least 30 years old. They also must have been a citizen of the United States for 9 years. And at the time of election, they too must live in the state in which they are chosen. But who would elect them? The question raised an interesting issue. It concerned democracy. In 1787, the word democracy meant something very different from what it means today. To many of the men meeting in Philadelphia, democracy meant mob rule. To give power to the people was an invitation to anarchy. Still, George Mason of Virginia argued for popular elections. The people will be represented, Mason said, so they should choose their representatives. James Wilson of Pennsylvania agreed. He stated firmly that the people must elect at least one branch of the national legislature. That, he said, was a basic condition for free government. The majority of the convention agreed with Mason. The delegates decided that members of the House of Representatives should be elected directly by the people. Akhil Reed Amar is a professor at Yale Law School in Connecticut. He says the delegates' decision to let people elect their representatives helped change the meaning of the word democracy.
The success of the American Constitutional Project has proved to the rest of the world that democracy can work, government of, by, and for the people, can survive and flourish, and this has been a model for the rest of the world.
However, most delegates agreed that the state legislatures would choose the representatives to the second legislative branch, the Senate. It remained that way for more than 100 years. In 1913, the states approved the 17th Amendment to the Constitution. This amendment legalized the direct election of senators by the people. How long would lawmakers serve? Roger Sherman of Connecticut thought representatives to the House should be elected every year. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts agreed. He thought a longer term would lead to a dictatorship. James Madison of Virginia protested. It will take almost 1 year, he said, just for lawmakers to travel to and from the seat of government. Madison proposed a 3-year term, but the delegates finally agreed on 2 years. There were many ideas about the term for senators. A few delegates thought they should be elected for life. In the end, the convention agreed on a Senate term of 6 years. Next came a debate about the pay for elected officials. How much should they get? Or should they be paid at all? Some delegates thought the states should pay their representatives to the national legislature. Others said the national legislature should decide its own pay and take it from the national treasury. That idea, James Madison argued, was shameful. He thought the amount should be set by the Constitution. Again, Madison lost the argument. The Constitution states only that lawmakers will be paid for their services and that the money will come from the national treasury. Finally, the time came for the convention to face the issue of representation in the House and Senate. The large states still wanted representation based on population, and the small states still wanted equal representation. The delegates had voted on the issue several times since the convention began. But both sides stood firm. Yet they knew they could not continue to vote forever, day after day. So the delegates did what large groups often do when they cannot reach agreement. They voted to create a committee. This grand committee would try to develop a compromise. The rest of the delegates would enjoy themselves during the July 4th holiday marking American independence. July 4th, Independence Day. It marked the 11th anniversary of America's Declaration of Independence from British rule. The celebration was especially important in Philadelphia. It was the city where the Declaration of Independence was signed. Now it was the city where a new nation was being created. Convention President George Washington led a group of delegates to a ceremony at a Philadelphia church. They heard a speech written especially for them. Your country looks to you with both worry and hope, the speaker said. Your country depends on your decisions. Your country believes that men such as you, who led us in our war for independence, will know how to plan a government that will be good for all Americans. Surely we have the ability to design a government that will protect the liberties we have won. After the speech, Benjamin Franklin urged the convention to ask for God's help. He said each meeting should begin with a prayer. Hugh Williamson of North Carolina quickly ended any discussion of Franklin's idea. The convention, he said, had no money to pay a minister to lead the delegates in prayer. On July 5th, the Grand Committee presented a two-part compromise. It provided something for large states and something for small states. It called for representation based on population in the House and for equal representation in the Senate. The committee said both parts of the compromise must be accepted or both rejected. Delegates debated the compromise for many days. They knew if they did not reach agreement, the convention would fail. Those were dark days in Philadelphia. Later, Luther Martin of Maryland noted that the newspapers reported on how much the delegates agreed. But that was not the truth. "We were on the edge of breaking up," Martin said. "We were held together only by the strength of a hair." Delegates Robert Yates and John Lansing of New York had left the convention in protest. But George Mason of Virginia declared he would bury his bones in Philadelphia before he would leave without an agreement. Even General George Washington was depressed. He wrote to Alexander Hamilton, who had returned to New York temporarily. "I am sorry you went away," Washington said. "Our discussions are now, if possible, worse than ever. There is little agreement on which a good government can be formed. I have lost almost all hope of seeing a successful end to the convention, and so I regret that I agreed to take part." On July 16th, the convention voted on the issue for the last time. It accepted what is called the Great Compromise. But even this agreement raised another problem. If representation was based on population, who would you count? Would you count just free people? Or would you count Negro slaves too?
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.